This is the time set for oral argument in U.S. Bank N.A. as trustee for the specialty underwriting of residential finance trust mortgage loan asset backed certificates, series 2006-BC4 versus Thunder Properties, Inc. and Westland Real Estate Development and Investments, case number 81129. As the record will reflect, five justices are present in court. Justice Stiglitz is participating by video, and Justice Silver, who has had a long-standing conflict with these days of arguments, is going to be participating in the case by listening to the oral argument and participating later in conference when we conference on the case, and she'll be part of the decision. Our counsel ready to proceed? Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Stern. And you may remove your mask if you wish during argument.
Good morning, Your Honors. Ariel Stern on behalf of U.S. Bank. My plan is to reserve 6 minutes and see how that goes. To answer the first question certified by the Ninth Circuit, this court should start its analysis with the nature of the claim and the type of relief that U.S. Bank seeks. Because U.S. Bank's claim is for a declaratory judgment that would stabilize and determine an as of yet undetermined and unstable and disputed juror question. The statute of limitations that applies under City of Fernley is no statute. Should the court disagree with that and find that a statute should apply, the court should by analogy apply NRS 11.080 and hold that a five-year statute of limitations applies to the claim. The court should further hold that the statute of limitations begins to run at the time that a title holder challenges or attempts to dispossess the lien holder of the lien, and in that way apply NRS 11.080 in perfect harmony with the court's holding in Burbridge versus Bank of America. But I'd like to start with why, under City of Fernley, there is no statute of limitations for the claim. As City of Fernley explained, there is no statute of limitations where the declaratory action seeks to confirm a disputed jural question, and that is what we have here. The bank's position has been that the HOA sale in this case did not affect its pre-existing deed of trust for a number of reasons, critically for our case because of the excuse of tender. The relief that the bank seeks is simply a declaration that that is in fact the case. The bank does not seek to go back into the past and rearrange the party's rights and responsibilities, nor does the bank ask for a court sitting in equity to reestablish or reinstate the lien of its deed of trust. It simply asks for a simple declaration of what the effect of the sale was. And this is, under City of Fernley, prospective. And the reason for that is, under City of Fernley, the court explained that when the declaratory judgment does nothing more than resolve an open and disputed question, the relief is prospective. It looks at the present rights and at the future rights, and that's what we have here. City of Fernley itself based itself on a New York case from 1941, in which the court, the New York Court of Appeals, explained that where the declaratory judgment, in its words, would settle a practical question, such as determining and stabilizing something that's uncertain, it is not subject to a statute of limitations. And that's what we have here. In this case, as I stated, the bank seeks a prospective remedy. That remedy simply clarifies and confirms what by operation of law is already the case, which is that the super priority component of the lien was not part of the sale because of the excuse of tender.
So, Mr. Stern, excuse me, ma'am, we require mask wearing in the common area. So I apologize for the interruption. We have a mask available to you if you need one. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate the chance to catch my breath. Thank you.
No problem. Thank you. Appreciate the accommodation.
So for those reasons, that the relief that the bank seeks here intended to settle an open and unresolved question and nothing more. Under City of Fernley, we do not have a statute of limitations that bars relief.
Mr. Sturm, wouldn't that same reasoning apply to every quiet title case? You know, anytime you come in on a quiet title, it's trying to settle what's the status of title moving forward. So wouldn't that always be, in a sense, prospective?
I think, Justice Kadish, a couple of points in response to that. First of all, with respect to this particular case, the bank's position, and I think there's agreement on the parties here, hopefully among the court as well, is that we do not actually have a quiet title. And the reason for that is that we do not have rival claims to title. We have a title holder who claims title and whose title we actually, as the bank, do not dispute.
And but you're seeking relief to determine the status of title, including whether the deed of trust is still of record on this property.
That is correct, Mr. Cadiz. We're seeking confirmation that the lien continues to cloud that title, but because we do not seek to dispossess title,
right,
other than through foreclosure, our position is that we're not really in a quiet title case here. But to understanding the court's concern a little bit further, aside from that technical but in our view important distinction, in fact, as Burbridge versus Bank of America clarified, the statute for statute of limitations for a quiet title case is 11080, which, as clarified by Burbridge, does not begin to run until the title holder is somehow either ejected, dispossessed, or has the validity of its ownership or possession challenged. And so we're here in the Burbridge example where it is a quiet title action, at least according to the precedent of the court, which we do not ask the court to second guess. In that quiet title context, as explained in Burbridge, the statute of limitations only runs or only begins when the title holder is dispossessed, which a lien holder will never do. A lien holder will not in any instance challenge, for example, here Thunder's property based on a rival claim of title. It would be simply on a claim that a pre-existing lien, which attaches to title, continues to run. And so in practical terms, the statute of limitations in a lien holder versus title holder situation, regardless of who the plaintiff is, or I should say even when the title holder is the plaintiff, can be at some point very far into the future.
So if U.S. Bank next week filed a notice of default regarding a default on payments and an intent to go down the road toward foreclosure, would that trigger a time period for the property owner to bring a claim?
Burbridge strongly suggests that it would not. And Burbridge actually cites a California case in which the California court expressly said that dispossession of title or the challenging of the validity of title is not accomplished by the mere reporting of a notice of default. There has to be something more. Now, that's not the central holding of Burbridge, but Burbridge cites case law to that effect. And I think to take the example just even a step further, we could potentially have a situation where if we were to assume that neither party had sued one another, Thunder at some point in the far distant future, 15, 20 years from now, arguably, conceivably, could have at that point decided to sue to seek the same relief that we seek here, declaratory relief about the effect of the sale. And under Burbridge, the statute of limitations still would not have run. And I think there may be a little bit of a conceptual qualm about that on the part of some, that it should make sense that there should be some tighter statute of limitations here. But it's actually, and I think it's Burbridge again that cites and footnote 4, that many states, including our neighboring state of Utah, do not have statutes of limitations for quiet title cases. And so if this court, the Ninth Circuit has not asked about this, and I don't think either party asks for this, but if the court were to somehow say, you know what, we're going to take a second look at 11080 and determine that it's not only not the applicable statute, that a quiet title claim has no statute of limitations, it would not be a radical departure. It would actually be joining many other states that have that rule. So in brief, before the 6 minutes I want to reserve, the alternative argument that we presented here is that if the court does not agree with that and believes that there is a statute of limitation that has to apply here, The most, what the court needs to do under its precedent, most recently Perry versus Carol Hertz, is to analyze the nature of the claim and the relief sought. And based on those analyses, apply the most analogous statute of limitations. And here, 11080 is the most analogous because it would be the statute that this court in Murbridge, as I already said, applies if the plaintiff happens to be Thunder. And it really should not make any difference whether the lien holder or the title holder happens to be the plaintiff or the defendant. We're talking about the same evidence, the same rules of law, the same application of law to evidence, the same witnesses. They're essentially mirror images of each other. And so the most analogous statute for that reason is 11080, since this court has already determined that it would apply to this case had, just by happenstance, Thunder been in the position of the plaintiff and the bank in the position of the defendant. We also ask by the same analogy that the statute, answering the third question of the Ninth Circuit posed, that the statute commences to run when the party, in this case Thunder, either dispossesses the bank of the lien, which is, I'm not sure how that would happen, but at a very minimum, challenge the validity of the deed of trust, which the sale itself is not sufficient. They would have to be something more than that. And so we ask that in the alternative, 11080 be applied with complete symmetry, both in terms of the statute that applies and when the limitation period commences. And with that, I guess I'll be preserving 5 minutes. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Gilbert.
Chief Justice Hardesty, pardon me. Chief Justice Hardesty and Justices, with me today, I'm representing both Thunder Properties, Inc., the respondent, and Amicus SFR Investments Pool 1 LLC, Mr. Cruteau for Thunder Properties, and Ms. Ebron for SFR are also with me at the table. 7 years ago, when Mr. Stern and I were here, Justice Gibbons asked a question at the very end of the argument. And that was, can a purchaser at a HOA foreclosure sale obtain title insurance? The answer was and remains no. And if the banks have their ways, it'll be never. And that is because, and that will end up with, and under Mr. Stern's argument here, is that our children and grandchildren, all of us, will be arguing and hearing these cases in 30, 40 years from now.
Counsel, this is Justice Stiglitz, counsel. What about, I'm sorry, you're looking around, where am I? Why wouldn't the 10-year in 106-240 operate kind of as a backstop to what you're talking about?
Because 106-240, depending on the case, depends on whether the bank ever records a notice of default or has ever, even in the background, accelerated a loan. As long as they've taken no action to show that they've accelerated a loan or found it, then ostensibly it would run until the deed of trust, the maturity date on the deed of trust. So unless the purchaser has a reason to believe that the 106-240 runs, and in this case there actually may be an argument there, but in general, and default may be it. It may be that, hey, somebody stopped paying their HOA dues, but they must have also stopped paying the bank, especially if they bought back in 2005, 2006, 2007. They may have a reason to bring it because it may be that the bank accelerated in the background and just hasn't taken any further steps. But if, for example, in this case, Justice Stiglitz, it's a 2006 deed of trust, which means that we could be here till 2046. With the potential of a lawsuit. And that's why a statute of limitations has to apply. And Mr. Stern says that there is uncertainty. There's no uncertainty here. The legislature set the certainty. The legislature says that there are conclusive recitals of default. There's conclusive recitals of proper noticing. It's conclusive that title passed without equity or right of redemption. There's presumptions in favor of the title holder. There's presumptions that the sale was properly held. All those exist because it's a non-judicial foreclosure sale. And because there has to be some presumptions in favor of the purchaser. This is not caveat emptor. There are presumptions the legislator put in place so that people will actually come to foreclosure sales and purchase. That doesn't change just because there's an NRS 116 in front of the statute. It's the same no matter what a non-judicial foreclosure sale is. It's the purpose, finality. There's also a reason to put a statute of limitations on when a bank can challenge the deed of trust, the foreclosure deed, and the sale, and that's because of evidence. The bank is asking you to write out all those presumptions and conclusive recitals that I just gave you that the legislature set up as a law, and they're asking you to rewrite those as a presumption of payment, as a presumption that there was not proper noticing, as a presumption that something took place in the background in hidden facts that isn't in the public record. In this case, they're claiming it's futility, and say, the foreclosure deed doesn't really mean anything. The legislature set up the wall. That's not the law in this state. The law in this state is that NRS 116-31162 provides an HOA of true super priority lien, foreclosure of which will extinguish a first deed of trust. The recitals in the foreclosure deed and the notices that say that there is a default and that it's going to pass title, those things give a presumption that there was a super priority lien. The bank wants to challenge everything that exists, that the legislature set forth, and that this court said, then it needs to do so, and it needs to do so affirmatively. And it can't hide behind declaratory relief. It can't use city affirmative. This is why we ask you to look carefully at the cases that were cited in the amicus brief, Evans and Davis. Davis is almost directly on point. You can't force somebody into coming to court and then claim a defensive position and call it either declaratory relief, I'm repudiating. I have defenses to this. You can't do that. The bank can't pretend. They can't pretend that there's a valid reason to challenge all of the presumptions and conclusive recitals without coming to court, determine it on its own, file a non-judicial foreclosure sale, and force the purchaser to come into court 20 years from now, 5 years from now, 6 years from now, whatever, and manipulate the system to evade the statute of limitations that should fall on them. They don't have a right to do that. They can call it, put whatever title they want on it. If you look at Evans, who's the aggressor? Who is trying to change the status quo? If you look at the public records, the status quo is deed of trust, HOA foreclosure notices, HOA foreclosure sale. That sets the status quo. That's what the legislature intended.
So just assume, and obviously we're not supposed to in this context get into and we don't really know yet what the facts are of this case, and maybe we won't depending on what happens here. But for example, in the cases where there's either an actual tender was made by the lender, or in circumstances where we have found futility might apply, we've held that in those circumstances, as a matter of law, that the foreclosure was not on a super priority lien, that super priority lien had ceased to exist. And in that circumstance, then the deed of trust remains in place. So I guess that's a long way of getting to, then your argument is, though, if that's the case, then they have to file a case within some statute of limitation period. But I guess, you know, if from the bank's perspective, they tendered, they still have their deed of trust. Why do they have to file a lawsuit?
And the reason they have to file a lawsuit, Justice Kadish, is the following. First, there was a dispute. So the bank doesn't get to decide that it
what did. Dispute? What,
dispute between the HOA and the bank as to whether that was a proper tender at the time of all of these. Had Diamondsburg didn't have a statute of limitations issue in it.
Right.
But had the bank gone ahead, in this case, didn't happen, didn't pay. In any case, if they went ahead.
I don't think we know that. Well, I don't know that anyway. Go ahead.
Went ahead and Mr. Stern, I believe, said it's a futility of tender.
Okay.
So.
Got it.
If they had gone ahead and foreclosed before the HOA foreclosed, there'd be no need to bring a lawsuit. There's nobody else involved. But they didn't. They chose to keep hidden facts. I'm not talking about who wins on the merits if it's brought timely. Not talking about that. Please don't misconstrue what I'm saying. Okay? But they're relying on facts not available to the public. Somebody who goes and looks at the public records say this, 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 and this. The facts they're relying on are private. And if they want to rely on those, they have to come to court and have a court deem that what they did was proper. And they have to do that within a specific amount of time. They don't get to force a challenge.
Let's get to the question that we've been asked
here,
the amount of time.
Okay.
I mean, I understand your point, but I think we've gotten a field of the question that's been presented for us to address.
Okay.
And so to Mr. Stern's argument, if I understand it correctly, he's saying that 11080 applies if Burbridge doesn't apply. I'd like you to address that argument, please.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because there does seem to be some validity to the suggestion that there's a difference between a quiet title claim between a lender and an owner of property or a subsequent purchaser of property versus the sequence or the order of liens on property. So why doesn't 11080 apply?
Because 11080 doesn't apply because those 70080 go directly to who has actual title. That's what those are for, is for recovery of title or an action brought by people disputing title.
Well, no, it's the recovery of real property. And the deed of trust is an interest in real property.
Yes.
And they're not claiming that your client is not the owner if they prevail. They're claiming that they have a deed of trust on your client's property. That's not the ownership of the property. They're wanting to recover an interest in that lien or maintain the interest in that lien. So correct. It seems to me there's a distinction between a quiet title action with a three-year statute and a recovery of property with a five-year statute under 11080.
Again, Your Honor, if the legislature meant it to be a recovery of an interest in property, it would have said so. Even Mr. Stern acknowledges that the real language of the statute doesn't apply. They said that in their briefing. It's not most analogous. What they are looking for is a challenge to the foreclosure deed and the foreclosure sale.
So you've been arguing there needs to be a time. Why do you, what's your position? What time should we adopt?
I believe.
How should we answer the question?
My client believes that it depends on what the challenge is. Therefore, the statutes, this is a foreclosure sale. So the challenge to the recitals of noticing, the recitals of default, et cetera, should adopt the ones at 30 to 90 days. Mm-hmm. A bank knows what it did or didn't do during that time. It knows what its challenges should be. But if that seems a little short, even though it isn't, then it's a wrongful foreclosure. Something was wrong with the foreclosure and it shouldn't have foreclosed out my deed. That's 3-year statute of limitations. But at the very most, the catch-all at 4 years, because the 5-year just doesn't apply. And the legislature recently in SB 107 just adopted. They have actually, going forward, have taken the discretion from the court and says that if there's nothing expressed that fits under what's in Chapter 11 or in another statute, you must use the catch-all of 4 years. So at the most, it would be 4 years. And the time would start from the foreclosure sale, because that's when anybody looking at the records, they see that the deed of trust was put into question. That's when the bank has its chance to try and revive or show that it was never extinguished. Something may happen as a matter of law, but this court only allows them to do that because it opened a door in Shadowwood and Shadow Canyon. But the court has to close that door so that people who they want to come, that the legislator wanted to come and buy its sales, could know what they bought. They don't have to file a lawsuit. They get to have certainty after a certain amount of time. They get to have certainty that nobody can challenge it and that a title company knows that there won't be a time in the future after this time has passed that some bank can come around, take something like Davis, force somebody into, change the status quo of the public records, force somebody into a lawsuit, claim a defense, so that they can get title insurance and have their whole bundle of sticks. The bank is seeking coercive results. They want this court to say they're entitled to part of those sticks and I have to come get them back. No, that's not how it works. You want part of the sticks that I bought getting title without equity or right of redemption? Then you come to court and do it. You don't get to put me in a position that allows you an unlimited time.
Before you run out of time, can you address what you feel triggers the statute of limitations?
Yes, I believe the statute of limitations is triggered by the foreclosure sale itself, the HOA's foreclosure sale, the very least when the because that's what calls into question the deed of trust. If we're going by public records, the recording of the foreclosure deed. Is there no more questions?
Any other questions? No, I don't see any. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Stern, I'm going to ask you the same or similar question I asked counsel. Let's focus on the question that was posed to us. Why wouldn't we consider NRS 107.080 for purposes of the challenge you've made here? Your challenge is that there's a problem in the foreclosure sale.
That's just as hard to say. I think you should consider it if you don't buy the consider-friendly argument. If the court is not convinced by that, that's our alternative argument, and we believe in it. It's, I think, the most analogous 11080 for the reasons I stated in my opening
presentation. I'm sorry, we've got a lot of numbers floating around.
Yeah.
I said 107.080.
Oh, I apologize. You know, it's
which, as you know, and I'm sure you won't agree to this, but yeah, that would create a very short time frame within which a challenge can be brought to a foreclosure sale under a deed of trust.
Understood, and I apologize for mishearing that. 107.080 does not apply for a couple of reasons. We start with the Blaha case, Las Vegas Development Group versus Blaha, which I already said that statute applies only when the challenge is to the procedure. Things like the notice went to the wrong person or there was no notice. This type of challenge, the one we're dealing with here now, is substantive. It has to do with the rights that were conveyed at the sale. And so under Blaha, it doesn't apply. And so
what is the nature of the challenge here?
The nature of the challenge here is about the rights that were conveyed at the sale rather than the process. And so Blaha has already held that 107.080 does not apply in the challenge such as this one, where we're dealing with substance rather than process, such as did the notices go out, et cetera. Beyond Blaha interrupting the analogy here, there is also the fact that, and without asking the court to overturn or further change its jurisprudence as announced under Blaha, a close reading of 107.080 actually suggests that the best interpretation of that statute is as a safe harbor. Because what the statute says is that if certain things are met, including the filing within the time period and other substantive things, at that point, the court must, without discretion, must award relief, and under 107.080 subsection 7, the rights of the bona fide purchaser do not matter. And so, I think the best reading of 107.080 is as a safe harbor that protects the former title holder if he or she meets those certain requirements and allows that challenge to withstand the, what would otherwise be a valid BFP defense.
I want to be sure I understand this, so I'm going to ask you this question and then ask if opposing counsel agrees. For all the disagreements that exist in the case, my understanding is that you both agree that the starting point is understanding the nature of the claim you're bringing.
Yes, Justice Hardesty, that comes straight from Perry versus Terrible Hurst and other.
Do you agree with that?
Yes.
Thank you.
And I think, Justice Hardesty, to take that a little bit further in my remaining 2 minutes, the I think Thunder and SFR and the others, and I would implore the court, I know you're going to do this anyway, but I think it bears repeating that this and the HOA versus bank thing, this is probably our swan song. This is probably the last one, if not among the last
Can
cases.
I get that in writing?
Yeah.
We were just talking about this before. This is probably the last major issue that we had. So this precedent that's going to come out of this is really going to affect other lien holders and title holders. And that's why I think it's important for the court to think about the implication of what Thunder and SFR have asked here. What they have said is that the sale is what triggers the statute. And that is, that's even in a case such as this one where we allege, because of the Perla del Mar precedent, that there was no super priority. And so by operation of law, the nature of our claim is that there was no super priority sale. But if at the same time you start the statute at the time of sale, you're essentially adopting the presumptions that Thunder and SFR asked you to do, but which, as we explained in our briefs, don't.
Taking you back to the gravamen of your case or the claim, you're saying that what is at issue here is not the process, but it's the rights conveyed. So why wouldn't we focus on the sale date as opposed to the notice? At the time of the notice, we don't know what rights have been conveyed. No rights have been conveyed. It's only when the sale occurs that an issue surrounding what rights have been conveyed is at issue.
I think, Justice Hardesty, that at the sale date, the of course, any district court trying to disentangle one of these cases has to look at the sale date as part of its analysis and determination.
Do you mean the sale date or the date the foreclosure deed is recorded?
I think it's the date of the recording of the foreclosure deed. That's when it's been delivered.
Yeah, I think that would be more precise.
And recorded. I agree with that, but in my last few seconds here, if I can finish the thought, the issue that's presented there is we know that by operation of law, there are some HOA cases that do not involve a super priority component. And so if you put the statute of limitations as starting on the date of sale, you're imposing that presumption that would overrule Bank of America versus SFR and Perla del Mar. You would introduce a substantive problem there that by operation of law should not be presumed. And that's our issue with the sale date or the reporting of the.
Chief, can I ask?
Yes, of course.
So then, and I understand your initial position is no statute of limitations, right. But if we pick one of these statutes of limitations, the longest of them is, I think 5 years, the longest of them that anyone's talked about.
Yes.
What do you say would trigger it if not the sale?
If not the sale, Justice Kadish, it would be in perfect congruity with Burbridge. It would be when the validity of the bank's lien is questioned. And that would not be the sale date because, as this case, or Perla del Mar, or Diamond Spur, which is our abbreviation for Bank of America versus SFR Investments, in those cases, by operation of law, there was no super priority sale. Right? So, it would have to be something more proactive on the part of Thunder to come and sue us or in some other way challenge the validity. They can't just rely on the sale. The sale delivers a warranty-less title. And we explain the presumptions and the problems with the presumptions in our briefs. I don't think we need to get into that here, but that's why the sale, if the sale is the date, you're really importing a substantive presumption in favor of the buyer here that would contradict what the court held in those recent precedents.
So like and I don't know, obviously we're not looking at facts in this case because of the way it comes to us, but if there had been correspondence back and forth with the buyer at the sale or something like that, would that do it? You know, some correspondence where we say, no, we are in place, and they say, no, you're not.
Potentially that could, Justice Cage. Of course, that would be a question of fact for the district court.
Right, and I know we don't have that. I'm just trying to think through how the rule would apply going forward, because if we're being asked to say what the rule is.
And I think if the rule, as announced by this court, leaves some wiggle room for district courts to do some fact-finding, you can have a very consistent approach where you follow Burbridge in mirror image, but allow fact-finding to see just when that trigger point is.
Right.
And you're not equating it with the sale, but you're also not saying it's open-ended forever. I think you can accomplish that or have district courts instructed to accomplish that.
Are there any other questions for Mr. Stern? Okay, well, counsel, we thank you very much for your briefing and your arguments. I'm excited to see the beginning of this opinion, which will read, based upon the stipulation of counsel in the foreclosure bar, this is the last appeal of these subjects.